Side 5, The Diamond Throne, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 198. "What was that all about?" Calton demanded. The blonde man was red-faced and panting from his exertions. "I'll chase one of them down and ask him, my lord," Bayret offered eagerly. "No," Sparhawk told him. Bayret's face fell. "A novice must not volunteer, Bayret," Kurek told the young man sternly, "at least not until he's proficient with his weapons."
"I did all right, Kurek," Bayret protested.
"Only because these people weren't very good," Kurek said.
"Your swings are too wide, Bayret. You leave yourself open for counterstrokes. When we get to my farm in Deimos, I'll give you some more instruction."
"Sparhawk!"
Sophrenia cried from the bottom of the hill. Sparhawk spun Theron quickly around and saw five men on foot wearing the rough smocks of Styrix running out of the bushes beside the road towards Sophrenia, Dolmant, and Talon. He swore and drove his spurs into Theron's flanks. It quickly became obvious that the Styrix were trying to reach Sophrenia and Flute. Sophrenia, however, was not utterly defenseless. One of the Styrix fell squealing to the ground, clutching at his belly. Another dropped to his knees, clawing at his eyes. The other three faltered, fatally as it turned out, because by then Sparhawk was there. He sent one man's head flying with a single swipe of his sword, then drove his blade into the chest of another. The last Styrix tried to flee, but Theron took the bit between his teeth and ran him down with three quick bounds and trampled him into the earth with his steel-shod forehooves.
"There!"
Sophrenia said sharply, pointing at the hilltop. A robed and hooded figure sat astride a pale horse, watching. Even as the small Styrix woman began her incantation, the figure turned and rode back over the hill and out of sight.
"Who were they?"
Calton asked as he joined them on the road.
"Mercenaries," Sparhawk replied. "You could tell by their armor."
"Was that one up on the hill the leader?" Dolmant asked. Sophrenia nodded.
"He was a Styrix, wasn't he?"
"Perhaps. But perhaps something else. I sensed something familiar about him. Once before, something tried to attack the little girl. Whatever it was driven off. This time it tried more direct means."
Her face grew dreadfully serious.
"Sparhawk," she said, "I think we should ride on to Deimos as quickly as we can. It's very dangerous out here in the open."
"We could question the wounded," he suggested. "Maybe they could tell us something about this mysterious Styrix who seems so interested in you and Flute."
"They won't be able to tell you anything, Sparhawk," she disagreed. "If what was up there on that hill was what I think it was, they won't even have any memory of it."
"All right," he decided. "Let's ride, then." It was mid-afternoon when they reached Kurek's substantial farmstead just outside Deimos. The farm showed Kurek's careful attention to detail. The logs forming the walls of his large house had been adzed square, and they fit tightly together with no need for chinking. The roof was constructed of overlapping split shakes. There were several outbuildings and storage sheds all built back into the side of the hill just behind the house, and the two-story barn was of substantial size. The carefully tended kitchen garden was surrounded by a sturdy rail fence. A single brown and white calf stood at the fence, looking wistfully at the wilted carrot tops and frost-browned cabbages inside the garden. Two tall young men about the same age as Bayret were splitting firewood in the yard, and two others, slightly older, were repairing the barn roof. They all wore rough canvas smocks. Kurek swung down from his saddle and approached the two in the yard.
"How long has it been since you sharpened those axes?" he demanded gruffly.
"Father!" one of the young men exclaimed. He dropped his axe and roughly embraced Kurek. He was, Sparhawk noticed, at least a head taller than his sire.
The other lad shouted to his brothers on the roof of the barn, and they came sliding down to leap from the edge with no apparent concern for life or limb. Then Asladi came bustling out of the house. She was a plump woman wearing a gray homespun dress and a white apron. Her hair was touched at the temples with silver, but the dimples in her cheeks made her look girlish. She caught Kurek in a warm embrace, and for several moments Sparhawk's squire was surrounded by his family. Sparhawk watched almost wistfully.
"Regrets, Sparhawk?"
Sophrenia asked him gently. "A few, I suppose," he admitted.
"You should have listened to me when you were younger, dear one,"
That could be you, you know. My profession's a little too dangerous for me to include a wife and children in my life, Sophronia. He sighed. When the time comes, dear Sparhawk, you won't even consider that. The time, I think, has long since passed. We'll see, she replied mysteriously. We have guests, Aslati, Kurek told his wife. Aslati dabbed at her misty eyes with one corner of her apron and crossed to where Sparhawk and the others sat, still mounted. Welcome to our home, she greeted them simply. She curtsied to Sparhawk and Calton, both of whom she had known since they were boys. Milords, she said formally. Then she laughed. Come down here, you two, she said, and give me a kiss. Like two clumsy boys, they slid from their saddles and embraced her. You're looking well, Aslati, Sparhawk said, trying to recover some degree of dignity in the presence of Patriarch Dolmant. Thank you, my lord, she said with a mocking little curtsy. Aslati had known them far too long to pay much attention to customary usages. Then she smiled broadly. She patted her ample hips. I'm getting stouter, Sparhawk, she said. It comes from all the tasting when I cook, I think. She shrugged good-humoredly. But you can't tell if it's right unless you taste it. Then she turned to Sophronia. Dear, dear Sophronia, she said. It's been so long. Too long, Aslati, Sophronia replied, sliding down from the back of her white palfrey and taking Aslati in her arms. Then she said something in Styric to Flute, and the little girl came shyly forward and kissed Aslati's palms. What a beautiful child, Aslati said. She looked a bit slyly at Sophronia. You should have told me, my dear, she said. I'm a very good midwife, you know, and I'm just a little hurt that you didn't invite me to officiate. Sophronia looked startled at that, then suddenly burst out laughing. It's not like that at all, Aslati, she said. There's a kinship between the child and me, but not the one you suggested. Aslati smiled at Dolmant. Come down from your horse, your grace, she invited the patriarch. Would the church permit us an embrace? A chaste one, of course. Then you'll get your reward. I've just taken 5 loaves from the oven, and they're still nice and hot. Dolmant's eyes brightened, and he quickly dismounted. Aslati threw her arms about his neck and kissed him noisily on the cheek. He married Kurek and me, you know, she said to Sophronia. Yes, dear, I was there, remember? Aslati blushed. I remember very little about the ceremony, she confessed. I had my mind on other things that day. She gave Kurek a wicked little smile. Sparhawk carefully concealed a grin when he saw his squire's face redden noticeably. Aslati looked inquiringly at Beirut and Talon. The husky lad is Beirut, Kurek introduced them. He's a Pandion novice. You're welcome here, Beirut, she told him. And the boy is my, apprentice, Kurek fumbled. I'm training him up to be a squire. Aslati looked appraisingly at the young thief. His clothes are a disgrace, Kurek, she said critically. Couldn't you have found him something better to wear? He has only recently joined us, Aslati, Kurek explained a little too quickly. She looked even more sharply at Talon. Do you know something, Kurek? She said. He looks almost exactly the way you looked when you were his age. Kurek coughed nervously. Coincidence? He muttered. Aslati smiled at Sophronia. Would you believe that I was after Kurek from the time I was 6 years old? It took me 10 years, but I got him in the end. Come down from your horse, Talon. I have a trunk full of clothes my son's about grown. We'll find something suitable for you to wear. Talon's face had a strange, almost wistful expression as he dismounted, and Sparhawk felt a sharp pang of sympathy as he realized what the usually impudent boy must be feeling. He sighed and turned to Dolmant. Do you want to go to the cloister now, your grace? He asked. And leave us Lottie's freshly baked bread to get cold? Dolmant protested. Be reasonable, Sparhawk. Sparhawk laughed as Dolmant turned to Kurek's wife. You have fresh butter, I hope? He asked. Churned yesterday morning, your grace, she replied, and I just opened a pot of that plum jam you're so fond of. Shall we step into the kitchen? Why don't we? Almost absently, Aslati picked up Flute in one arm and wrapped the other about Talon's shoulders. and then, with the children close to her, she led the way into the house. The walled cloister in which Princess Arissa was confined stood in a wooded glen on the far side of the city. Men were seldom admitted into this strict community of women, but Dolman's rank and authority in the church gained them immediate entry. A submissive little sister with doe-like eyes and a bad complexion led them to a small garden near the south wall, where they found the princess, sister of the late King Aldreas, sitting on a stone bench in the wan winter sunlight with a large book in her lap. The years had touched Arissa only lightly. Her long, dark blonde hair was lustrous, and her eyes a pale blue, so pale as to closely resemble the gray eyes of her niece, Queen Alana, although the dark circles beneath them spoke of long, sleepless nights filled with bitterness and a towering resentment. Her mouth was thin-lipped rather than sensual, and there were two hard lines of discontent at its corners. Although Sparhawk knew that she was approaching 40, her features were those of a much younger woman. She did not wear the habit of the Sisters of the Nunnery, but was wrapped instead in a soft red woolen robe, open at the throat, and her head was crowned with an intricately folded wimple. "I'm honored by your visit, gentlemen," she said in a husky voice, not bothering to rise. "I have so few visitors." "Your Highness," Sparhawk greeted her formally, "I trust you've been well."
"Well, but bored, Sparhawk."
Then she looked at Dolmant. "You've aged, Your Grace," she observed spitefully, closing her book.
"But you have not," he replied. "Will you accept my blessing, Princess?" "I think not, Your Grace. The church has done quite enough for me already."
She looked meaningfully around at the walls enclosing the garden, and her refusal of the customary blessing seemed to give her some pleasure. He sighed.
"I see," he said.
"What is the book you read?" he asked her. She held it up for him to see. "The Sermons of the Primate Sabata," he noted. "A most instructional work." She smiled maliciously. "This particular edition is even more so," she told him. "I had it made especially for me, Your Grace. Within this innocent-looking cover, which deceives the Mother Superior, who is my jailer, there lurks a volume of salacious erotic poetry from Camoria. Would you care to have me read you a few verses?" His eyes hardened. "No, thank you, Princess," he replied coldly. "You have not changed, I see." She laughed mockingly. "I see no reason to change, Dolmant. I have merely altered my circumstances." "Our visit here is not social, Princess," he said. "A rumor has surfaced in Simera that prior to your being cloistered here, you were secretly married to Duke Osten of Vardanias. Would you care to confirm or deny that rumor?"
"Osten," she laughed. "That dried-up old stick. Who in her right mind would marry a man like that? I like my men younger, more ardent."
"You deny the rumor, then?"
"Of course I deny it. I'm like the church, Dolmant. I offer my bounty to all men, as everyone in Simera knows."
"Would you sign a document declaring the rumor to be false?"
"I'll think about it."
She looked at Sparhawk.
"What are you doing back in Alania, Sir Knight? I thought my brother exiled you."
"I was summoned back, Arissa."
"How very interesting."
Sparhawk thought of something. "Did you receive a dispensation to attend your brother's funeral, Princess?" he asked her.
"Why, yes, Sparhawk. The church generously granted me 3 whole days of mourning. My poor, stupid brother looked very regal as he lay on his bier in his state robes."
She critically examined her long, pointed fingernails.
"Death improves some people," she added.
"You hated him, didn't you?"
"I held him in contempt, Sparhawk. There's a difference. I always used to bathe whenever I left him."
Sparhawk held out his hand, showing her the blood-red ring on his finger. "Did you happen to notice if he had the mate to this on his finger?" he asked her. She frowned slightly.
"No," she said.
As a matter of fact, he didn't. Perhaps the brats told it after he died. Sparhawk clenched his teeth. Poor, poor Sparhawk, she said mockingly. You cannot bear to hear the truth about your precious Alana, can you? We used to laugh about your attachment to her when she was a child. Did you have hopes, great champion?
I saw her at my brother's funeral. She's not a child any more, Sparhawk. She has the hips and breasts of a woman now.
But she's sealed up in a diamond, isn't she? So you can't even touch her. All that soft, warm skin, and you can't even put so much as a finger on it.
I don't think we need to pursue this, Sarissa. He narrowed his eyes.
Who is your son's father? He asked her suddenly, hoping to startle the truth out of her. She laughed.
How could I possibly know that? She asked. After my brother's wedding, I amused myself in a certain establishment in Simera. She rolled her eyes. It was both enjoyable and profitable. I made a very great deal of money. Most of the girls there overpriced themselves. But I learned as a child that the secret of great wealth is to sell cheaply to many. She looked maliciously at Dolmant. Besides, she added, it's a renewable resource. Dolmant's face grew stiff and Arissa laughed coarsely.
That's enough, princess, Sparhawk told her. You would not care then to hazard a guess as to the identity of your bastard's father. He said it quite deliberately, hoping to sting her into some inadvertent revelation. Her eyes flashed with momentary anger, then she leaned back on the stone bench with a heavy-lidded look of voluptuous amusement. She put her hands to the front of her scarlet robe.
I'm a bit out of practice, but I suppose I could improvise. Would you like to try me, Sparhawk?
I don't think so, Arissa. Sparhawk's voice was flat.
Ah, the well-known prudery of your family. What a shame, Sparhawk. You interested me when you were a young knight. Now you've lost your queen, and there's not even that pair of rings to prove the connection between the two of you. Wouldn't that mean that you're no longer her champion? Perhaps, if she recovers, you might be able to establish a closer bond with her. She shares my blood, you know, and it might flow as hotly through her veins as it does through mine. If you were to try me, you could compare and find out.
He turned away in disgust, and she laughed again.
Shall I send for parchment and ink, princess? Dolmant asked, so that we may compose your denial of the rumor concerning your marriage.
No, Dolmant, she replied. I don't think so. This request of yours hints at the interest of the church in this matter. The church has done me few favors of late, so why should I exert myself in her behalf? If the people in Simera want to amuse themselves with rumors about me, let them. They licked their lips over the truth. Now let them enjoy a lie.
That's your final word, then?
I might change my mind. Sparhawk's a church knight, your grace, and you're a patriarch. Why don't you order him to see if he can persuade me? Sometimes I persuade easily, sometimes not. It all depends on the persuader.
I think we've concluded our business here, Dolmant said. Good day, princess.
He turned on his heel and started across the winter brown lawn of the garden.
Come back sometime when you can leave your stuffy friend behind, Sparhawk, Arissa said. We could amuse ourselves.
He turned without answering and followed the patriarch out of the garden.
I think we've wasted our time, he muttered, his face dark and angry.
Ah, no, my boy, Dolmant said serenely. In her haste to be offensive, the princess overlooked an important point in canon law. She has just made a free admission in the presence of two ecclesiastical witnesses, you and me. That has all the validity of a signed statement. All it takes is our oaths as to what she said.
Sparhawk blinked. Dolmant, he said, you're the most devious man I've ever known.
I'm glad you approve, my son. The patriarch smiled.
Chapter 12
They left Keurig's farmstead early the following morning.
as Ladi and her four sons stood in the dooryard waving as they rode out. Kurek remained behind for a few personal farewells, promising to catch up with them a bit later. "Are we going through the city?" Colton asked Sparhawk. "I don't think so," Sparhawk replied. "We can take the road that goes around the north side. I'm fairly sure that we'll be seen, but let's not make it easy for them." "Would you mind a personal observation?" "Probably not." "You really ought to give some thought to letting Kurek retire, you know. He's getting older, and he should be spending more time with his family instead of trailing along behind you all over the world. Besides, so far as I know, you're the only church knight who still has a squire. The rest of us have learned to get along without them. Give him a good pension and let him stay home." Sparhawk squinted at the sun, which was just rising above the wooded hilltop lying to the east of Deimos. "You're probably right," he agreed. "But how would I go about telling him? My father placed Kurek in my service before I completed my novitiate. It has to do with being hereditary champion of the royal house of Elenia." He smiled wryly. "It's an archaic position that requires archaic usages. Kurek's a friend more than a squire, and I'm not going to hurt him by telling him that he's too old to serve anymore." "It's a problem, isn't it?" "Yes," Sparhawk said. "It is." Kurek came riding up behind them as they were passing the cloister where Princess Arissa was confined. His bearded face was a bit glum, but then he straightened his shoulders and assumed a businesslike expression. Sparhawk looked gravely at his friend, trying to imagine life without him. Then he shook his head. It was totally impossible. The road leading toward Kyrelos passed through an evergreen forest where the morning sun streamed down through the boughs to spatter the forest floor with gold. The air was crisp and bright, although there was no frost. After they had gone about a mile farther, Beirut resumed his narrative. "The knights of the church were consolidating their position in Rendor," he told Talon, "when word reached Kyrelos that Emperor Otha of Zamok had massed a huge army and was marching into Lamorkand."
"Wait a minute," Talon interrupted him. "When did all this happen?"
"About 500 years ago."
"It wasn't the same Otha Colton was talking about the other day, then, was it?"
"So far as we know, it was."
"That's impossible, Beirut."
"Otha is perhaps 1900 years old," Sophronia told the boy.
"I thought this was a history," Talon accused, "not a fairy tale."
"When Otha was a boy, he encountered the elder god Azash," she explained. "The elder gods of Styricum have great powers and are not controlled by any form of morality. One of the gifts they can bestow upon their followers is the gift of a greatly expanded lifetime. That is why some men are willing to follow them."
"Immortality?" he asked her skeptically.
"No," she corrected, "not that. No god can bestow that."
"The Aline god can," Dolman said, "in a spiritual sense, anyway."
"That's an interesting theological point, Your Grace," she smiled. "Someday we'll have to discuss it." "Anyway," she continued, "when Otha agreed to worship Azash, the god granted him enormous power, and Otha eventually became emperor of Zamok. The Styrix and the Alines of Zamok have intermarried, and so Zamok is not truly a member of either race."
"An abomination in the eyes of God," Dolmant added.
"The Styrix gods feel much the same way," Sophronia agreed. She looked at Talon again. "To understand Otha and Zamok, one needs to understand Azash. He is the most totally evil force on earth. The rites of the worship of him are obscene. He delights in perversion and in blood and in the agonies of sacrificial victims. In their worship of him, the Zamoks have become much less than human, and their incursion into Lamorkand was accompanied by unspeakable horrors. Had the invading armies been only Zamoks, however, they might have been met and turned back by conventional forces. But Azash had reinforced them with creatures from the underworld."
"Goblins?" Talon asked disbelievingly.
"Not exactly, but the word will serve, I suppose. It would take most of the morning for me to describe the 20 or so varieties of inhuman creatures Azash has at his command, and you wouldn't like the descriptions."
"This story is getting less believable by the minute,"
Talon noted. I like the battles and all, but when you start telling me about goblins and fairies, I begin to lose interest. I'm not a child anymore, after all.
In time you may come to understand, and to believe, she said.
Go on with the story, Beirut.
Yes, ma'am, he said.
When the church realized the nature of the forces that were invading Lamorghan, they summoned the church knights back from Rendor. They reinforced the ranks of the four orders with other knights and with common soldiers, until the forces of the West were nearly as numerous as those of the Zamok horde of Otha.
Was there a battle then? Talon asked eagerly.
The greatest battle in the history of mankind, Beirut replied. The two armies met on the plains of Lamorghand near Lake Rondera. The physical battle was gigantic, but the supernatural battle on that plain was even more stupendous. Waves of darkness and sheets of flame swept the field. Fire and lightning rained from the sky. Whole battalions were swallowed up by the earth or burned to ashes in sudden flame. The crash of thunder rolled perpetually from horizon to horizon, and the ground itself was torn by earthquakes and the eruption of searing liquid rock. The magic of the Zamok priests was countered each time by the concerted magic of the knights of the church. For 3 days the armies were locked in battle before the Zamoks were pushed back. Their retreat became more rapid, eventually turning into a rout. Otha's horde finally broke and ran toward the safety of the border.
Terrific! Talon exclaimed excitedly.
And then did our army invade Zamok? They were too exhausted, Beirut told him. They had won the battle, but not without great cost. Fully half of the church knights lay slain upon the battlefield, and the armies of the Aline kings numbered their dead by the scores of thousands.
They could have done something, couldn't they?
Beirut nodded sadly. They cared for their wounded and buried their dead. Then they went home.
That's all? Talon asked incredulously. This isn't much of a story if that's all they did, Beirut.
They had no choice. They'd stripped the Western kingdoms of every able-bodied man to fight the war, and had left the crops untended. Winter was coming, and there was no food. They managed to eke their way through that winter, but so many men had been killed or maimed in the battle that when spring came there weren't enough people, in the West or in Zamok, to plant new crops. The result was famine. For a century, the only concern in all of Eosia was food. The swords and lances were put aside, and the war horses were hitched to plows.
They never talk about that sort of thing in other stories I've heard.
Talon sniffed.
That's because those are only stories, Beirut told him. This really happened.
Anyway, he went on, the war and the famine which followed caused great changes. The militant orders were forced to labor in the fields beside the common people, and they gradually began to distance themselves from the church.
Pardon me, Your Grace, he said to Dolmant, but at that time the hierocracy was too far removed from the concerns of the commons fully to understand their suffering.
There's no need to apologize, Beirut, Dolmant replied sadly. The church has freely admitted her blunders during that era.
Beirut nodded. The church knights became increasingly secularized. The original intent of the hierocracy had been that the knights should be armed monks who would live in their chapter houses when they weren't fighting. That concept began to fade. The dreadful casualties in their ranks made it necessary for them to seek a source for new recruits. The preceptors of the orders journeyed to Kyrelos and laid the problem before the hierocracy in the strongest of terms. The main stumbling block to recruitment had always been the vow of celibacy. At the insistence of the preceptors, the hierocracy relaxed that rule, and church knights were permitted to take wives and father children.
Are you married, Sparhawk?
Talon suddenly asked.
No, the knight replied.
Why not?
He hasn't found any woman silly enough to have him, Colton laughed. He's not very pretty to begin with, and he's got a foul temper.
Talon looked at Beirut.
That's the end of the story, then?
He asked critically.
A good story needs an end, you know, something like, and they all lived happily ever after. Yours just sort of dribbles off without going any place.
History just keeps going, Talon. There aren't any ends. The militant orders are now as much involved in political affairs as they are in the affairs of the church, and no one can say what lies in store for them in the future.
Dolmant sighed. All too true, he agreed. I wish it might have been otherwise, but perhaps God had his reasons for ordaining things this way.
Wait a minute,
Talon objected.
This all started when you were going to tell me about Otha and Zamok. He sort of fell out of the story a ways back. Why are we so worried about him now?
Otha is mobilizing his armies again, Sparhawk told him.
Are we doing anything about it?
We're watching him. If he comes again, we'll meet him the same way we did last time.
Sparhawk looked around at the yellow grass gleaming in the bright morning sunlight.
If we want to get to Kyrolos before the month's out, we're going to have to move a little faster, he said, touching his spurs to Farron's flanks. They rode east for 3 days, stopping each night in wayside inns. Sparhawk concealed a certain tolerant amusement as Talon, inspired by Beirut's recounting of the age-old story, fiercely beheaded thistles with a stick as they rode along. It was mid-afternoon of the third day when they crested a long hill to look down upon the vast sprawl of Kyrolos, the seat of the Aline Church. The city lay within no specific kingdom, but sat instead at the place where Elenia, Arsham, Camoria, Lamarkand, and Pelosia touched. It was by far the largest city in all of Eosia. Since it was a church city, it was dotted with spires and domes. At certain times of the day, the air above it shimmered with the sound of bells calling the faithful to prayer. No city so large, however, could be given over entirely to churches. Commerce, almost as much as religion, dominated the society of the holy city, and the palaces of wealthy merchants vied with those of the patriarchs of the church for splendor and opulence. The center and focus of the city, however, was the Basilica of Kyrolos, a vast domed cathedral of gleaming marble erected to the glory of God. The power emanating from the basilica was enormous, and it touched the lives of all Alenes, from the snowy wastes of northern Thalesia to the deserts of Rendor. Talon, who until now had never been out of Cimera, gaped in astonishment at the enormous city spread before them, gleaming in the winter sunlight.
"Good God!" he breathed, almost reverently.
"Yes," Dolmant agreed. "He is good, and this is one of his most splendid works." Flute, however, seemed unimpressed. She drew out her pipes and played a mocking little melody on them, as if to dismiss all the splendors of Kyrolos as unimportant. "Will you go directly to the Basilica, Your Grace?" Sparhawk asked. "No," Dolmant replied. "It's been a tiring journey, and I'll need my wits about me when I present this matter to the hierocracy. Ennius has many friends in the highest councils of the church, and they won't like what I'm going to say to them."
"They can't possibly doubt your words, Your Grace."
"Perhaps not. But they can try to twist them around." Dolmant tugged thoughtfully at one earlobe. "I think my report might have more impact if I have corroboration. Are you any good at public appearances?"
"Only if he can use a sword," Colton said.
Dolmant smiled faintly. "Come to my house tomorrow, Sparhawk. We'll go over your testimony together."
"Is that altogether legal, Your Grace?" Sparhawk asked.
"I won't ask you to lie under oath, Sparhawk. All I want to do is suggest to you how you should phrase your answers to certain questions." He smiled again. "I don't want you to surprise me when we're before the hierocracy. I hate surprises."
"All right then, Your Grace," Sparhawk agreed.
They rode on down the hill to the great bronze gates of the holy city. The guards there saluted Dolmant and let them all pass without question. Beyond the gate lay a broad street that could only be called a boulevard. Huge houses stood on either side, seeming almost to shoulder at each other in their eagerness to command the undivided attention of passers-by. The street teemed with people. Although many of them wore the drab smocks of workmen, the vast majority were garbed in somber ecclesiastical black.
"Is everybody here a churchman?" Talon asked.
The boy's eyes were wide as the sights of Kyrolos overwhelmed him. The cynical young thief from the back alleys of Cimera had finally seen something he could not shrug off.
"Hardly," Colton replied. "But in Kyrolos one commands a bit more respect if he's thought to be affiliated with the church, so everybody wears black."
"Frankly, I wouldn't mind seeing a bit more color in the streets of Kyrolos," Dolmant said. "All this unrelieved black depresses me."
"Why not start a new trend, then, Your Grace?" Colton suggested. "The next time you present yourself at the Basilica, wear a pink cassock, or maybe emerald green. You'd look very nice in green."
"The dome would collapse if I did," Dolmant said wryly.
The patriarch's house, unlike the palaces of most other high churchmen, was simple and unadorned. It was set slightly back from the street and was surrounded by well-trimmed shrubs and an iron fence. "We'll go on to the chapter house, then, Your Grace," Sparhawk said as they stopped at Dolman's gate. The patriarch nodded. "And I'll see you tomorrow." Sparhawk saluted, and then led the others on down the street. "He's a good man, isn't he?" Halton said. "One of the best," Sparhawk replied. "The church is lucky to have him." The chapter house of the Pandion Knights in Kyrelos was a bleak-looking stone building on a little-traveled side street. Although it was not moated as was the one in Cimera, it was nonetheless surrounded by a high wall and blocked off from the street by a formidable gate. Sparhawk went through the ritual which gained them entry, and they dismounted in the courtyard. The governor of the chapter house, a stout man named Nashan, came bustling down the stairs to greet them.
"Our house is honored, Sir Sparhawk," he said, clasping the big knight's hand. "How did things turn out in Cimera?"
"We managed to pull Anius' teeth," Sparhawk replied.
"How did he take it?"
"He looked a little sick."
"Good!"
Nashan turned to Sophrenia.
"Welcome, little mother," he greeted her, kissing both her palms.
"Nashan," she replied gravely, "I see that you're not missing too many meals."
He laughed and slapped at his paunch.
"Every man needs a vice or two," he said. "Come inside, all of you. I've smuggled a skin of Arshan Red into the house, for my stomach's sake, of course, and we can all have a goblet or two."
"You see how it works, Sparhawk," Galton said. "Rules can be bent if you know the right people." Nashan's study was draped and carpeted in red, and the ornate table which served as his desk was inlaid with gold and mother-of-pearl.
"A gesture," he said apologetically as he led them into the room and looked about.
"In Kyrelos we must make these little genuflections in the direction of opulence if we are to be taken seriously." "It's all right, Nashan," Sophrenia told him. "You weren't selected as governor of this chapter house because of your humility."
"One must keep up appearances, Sophrenia," he said.
He sighed.
"I was never that good a knight," he admitted. "I'm at best only mediocre with the lance, and most of my spells tend to crumble on me about halfway through."
He drew in a deep breath and looked around.
"I'm a good administrator, though. I know the church and her politics, and I can serve the Order and Lord Vanion in that arena probably far better than I could on the field."
"We all do what we can," Sparhawk told him. "I'm told that God appreciates our best efforts."
"Sometimes I feel that I've disappointed him," Nashan said. "Somewhere deep inside me, I think I might have done better."
"Don't flagellate yourself, Nashan," Sophrenia advised. "The Aline God is reputed to be most forgiving. You've done what you could."
They took seats around Nashan's ornate table, and the governor summoned an acolyte who brought goblets and the skin of the deep red Arshan wine. At Sophrenia's request, he also sent for tea for her and milk for Flute and Talon.
"We don't necessarily need to mention this to Lord Vanion, do we?"
Nashan said to Sparhawk as he lifted the wineskin.
"Wild horses couldn't drag it out of me, my lord," Sparhawk told him, holding out his goblet.
"So," Galton said, "what's happening here in Kyrelos?"
"Troubled times, Galton," Nashan replied. "Troubled times. The archprelate ages, and the entire city is holding its breath in anticipation of his death."
"Who will be the new archprelate?" Sparhawk asked.
"At the moment, there's no way to know. Clavonus is in no condition to name a successor, and Anius of Cimera is spending money like water to gain the throne."
"What about Dolmant?" Galton asked.
"He's too self-effacing, I'm afraid," Nashan replied. "He's so dedicated to the church that he doesn't have the sense of self that one needs to have to aspire to the golden throne in the basilica. Not only that, he's made enemies."
"I like enemies," Galton grinned. "They give you a reason to keep your sword sharp." Nashan looked at Sophrenia.
"Is there something afoot in Styricum?" he asked her.
"What exactly do you mean?"
"The city is suddenly awash with Styrics," he replied. "They say that they're here to seek instruction in the Aline faith."
"That's absurd."
"I thought so myself. The church has been trying to convert the Styrics for 3,000 years without much success, and now they come flocking to Kyrelos on their own accord, begging to be converted."
No sane Styric would do that, she insisted. Our gods are jealous, and they punish apostasy severely. Her eyes narrowed.
Have any of these pilgrims identified their place of origin? She asked.
Not that I've heard. They all look like common rural Styrics.
Perhaps they've made a longer journey than they're willing to reveal.
You think they might be Zamox? Sparhawk asked her.
Oath has already infested eastern Lamarkand with his agents, she replied. Kyrelos is the center of the Aline world. It's a logical place for espionage and disruption. She considered it. We're likely to be here for a while, she observed. We have to wait for the arrival of the knights from the other orders. I think that perhaps we might spend the time investigating these unusual postulants.
I can't really get too much involved in that, Sparhawk disagreed. I have things far more important on my mind just now. We'll deal with Otha and his Zamox when the time comes. Right now I have to concentrate on restoring Alana to her throne and preventing the deaths of certain friends.
He spoke obliquely, since he had kept to himself the details of what she had told him had taken place in the throne room in Cimera. It's all right, Sparhawk, she assured him. I understand your concern. I'll take Calton with me, and we'll see what we can turn up. They spent the remainder of the day in quiet conversation in Nashan's ornate study, and the following morning Sparhawk dressed in a mail coat and a simple hooded robe and rode across town to Dolman's house, where the two of them carefully went over what had happened in Cimera and Arsham.
It would be futile to level any direct charges at Anius, Dolman said, so it's probably best to omit any references to him, or to Harperin. Let's just present the affair as a plot to discredit the Pandion Order and leave it at that. The Hierocracy will draw its own conclusions. He smiled faintly. The least damaging of those conclusions will be that Anius made a fool of himself in public. If nothing else, that might help to stiffen the resolve of the neutral patriarchs when the time comes to select a new archprelate.
That's something, anyway, Sparhawk said. Are we going to present the matter of Arissa's so-called marriage at the same time?
I don't think so, Dolmant replied. It's really not a significant enough thing to require the consideration of the entire Hierocracy. The declarations of Arissa's spinsterhood can come from the Patriarch of Vardanias. The alleged wedding took place in his district, and he would be the logical one to draw up the denial that it took place. A smile touched his ascetic face. Besides, he added, he's a friend of mine.
Clever, Sparhawk said admiringly.
I rather liked it, Dolman said modestly.
When are we going before the Hierocracy?
Tomorrow morning. There's no point in waiting. All that would do is give Anius time to alert his friends in the Basilica.
Do you want me to come by here and ride to the Basilica with you?
No.
Let's go in separately. Let's not give them the slightest hint of what we're up to.
You're very good at political chicanery, Your Grace, Sparhawk grinned.
Of course I am. How do you think I got to be a patriarch?
Come to the Basilica during the third hour after sunrise. That should give me time to present my report first, and to answer all the questions and objections that Anius's supporters are likely to raise.
Very well, Your Grace, Sparhawk said, rising to his feet.
Be careful tomorrow, Sparhawk. They'll try to trip you up. And for God's sake, don't lose your temper.
I'll try to remember that. The following morning, Sparhawk dressed carefully. His black armor gleamed, and his cape and silver surcoat had been freshly pressed. Farron had been groomed until his roan coat shone, and his hooves had been oiled to make them glossy.
Don't let them back you into a corner, Sparhawk, Calton warned as he and Curic boosted the big man into his saddle. Churchmen can be very devious.
I'll watch myself.
Sparhawk gathered his reins and nudged Farron with his heels. The big roan pranced out through the chapter house gate and into the teeming streets of the holy city. The domed basilica of Kyrelos dominated the entire city. It was built on a low hill, and it soared toward heaven, gleaming in the wintry sun. The guards at the bronze portal admitted Sparhawk respectfully, and he dismounted before the marble stairs that led up to the great doors. He handed Farron's reins to a monk, adjusted the strap on his shield, and then mounted the steps, his spurs ringing on the marble.
At the top of the stairs, an officious young churchman in a black cassock blocked his path.
"Sir Knight," the young man protested, "you may not enter while under arms."
"You're wrong, Your Reverence," Sparhawk told him. "Those rules don't apply to the militant orders."
"I've never heard of any such exception."
"You have now. I don't want any trouble with you, friend, but I've been summoned by Patriarch Dolmant, and I'm going inside."
"But..."
"There's an extensive library here, neighbor. Why don't you go look up the rules again? I'm sure you'll find that you've missed a few. Now stand aside."
He brushed past the man in the black cassock and went on into the cool, incense-smelling cathedral. He made the customary bow toward the jewel-encrusted altar and moved on down the broad central aisle in the multicolored light streaming through tall stained-glass windows. A sacristan stood by the altar, vigorously polishing a silver chalice.
"Good morning, friend," Sparhawk said to him in his quiet voice.
The sacristan almost dropped the chalice.
"You startled me, Sir Knight," he said, laughing nervously. "I didn't hear you come up behind me."
"It's the carpeting," Sparhawk said. "It muffles the sound of footsteps. I understand that the members of the hierocracy are in session." The sacristan nodded. "Patriarch Dolmant summoned me to testify in a matter he's presenting this morning. Could you tell me where they're meeting?"
"In the archprelate's audience chamber, I believe. Do you want me to show you the way, Sir Knight?"
"I know where it is. Thanks, neighbor." Sparhawk went across the front of the nave and out through a side door into an echoing marble corridor. He removed his helm and tucked it under his arm, and proceeded along the corridor until he reached a large room where a dozen churchmen sat at tables sorting through stacks of documents. One of the black-robed men looked up, saw Sparhawk in the doorway, and rose.
"May I help you, Sir Knight?"
he asked. The top of his head was bald, and wispy tufts of gray hair stuck out over his ears like wings.
"The name is Sparhawk, Your Reverence. The Patriarch Dolmant summoned me."
"Ah, yes," the bald churchman said. "The Patriarch advised me that he was expecting you. I'll go tell him that you've arrived. Would you care to sit down while you're waiting?"
"No, thanks, Your Reverence. I'll stand. It's a little awkward to sit down when you're wearing a sword."
The churchman smiled a bit wistfully.
"I wouldn't know about that," he said. "What's it like?"
"It's overrated," Sparhawk told him. "Would you tell the Patriarch that I'm here?"
"At once," said Sparhawk.
The churchman turned and crossed the room to the far door with his sandals slapping on the marble floor. After a few moments, he came back.
"Dolmant says that you're to go right on in. The archprelate's with them."
"That's a surprise. I've heard that he's been ill."
"This is one of his better days, I think."
The churchman led the way across the room and opened the door for Sparhawk.
The audience chamber was flanked on either side by tier upon tier of high-backed benches. The benches were filled with elderly churchmen in sober black, the hierocracy of the Aline Church. At the front of the room, on a raised dais, sat a large golden throne, and seated upon that throne in a white satin robe and golden mitre was the archprelate Clavonis. The old man was dozing. In the center of the room stood an ornate lectern. Dolmant was there with a sheaf of parchment on the slanted shelf before him.
"Ah," he said, "Sir Sparhawk, so good of you to come."
"My pleasure, Your Grace," Sparhawk replied.
"Brothers," Dolmant said to the other members of the hierocracy,
"I have the honor to present the Pandion Knight, Sir Sparhawk."
"We have heard of Sir Sparhawk," a lean-faced patriarch seated in the front tier on the left said coldly. "Why is he here, Dolmant?"
"To present evidence in the matter we were just discussing, Makova," Dolmant replied distantly.
"I have heard quite enough already."
"Speak for yourself, Makova," a jovial-looking fat man said from the right tier. "The militant orders are the arm of the church, and their members are always welcome at our deliberations."
The two men glared at each other.
"Since Sir Sparhawk was instrumental in uncovering and thwarting this plot," Dolmant said smoothly, "I thought that his testimony might prove enlightening."
"Oh, get on with it, Dolmant,"
the lean-faced patriarch on the left said irritably.
"We have matters of much greater importance to take up this morning."
"It shall be as the esteemed patriarch of Coombe wishes."
Dolmant bowed.
"Sir Sparhawk," he said then, "do you give your oath as a knight of the church that your testimony shall be the truth?"
"I do, Your Grace,"
Sparhawk affirmed.
Please tell the Assembly how you uncovered this plot.
Of course, Your Grace. Sparhawk then recounted most of the conversation between Harperin and Crager, omitting their names, the name of the primate Annius, and all references to Elana.
Is it your custom to eavesdrop on private conversations, Sir Sparhawk?
Markova asked a bit spitefully.
When it involves the security of the church or the state, yes, Your Grace. I'm sworn to defend both.
Ah, yes. I'd forgotten that you are also the champion of the Queen of Elania. Does that sometimes not divide your loyalties, Sir Sparhawk?
It hasn't so far, Your Grace. The interests of the church and the state are seldom in conflict with each other in Elania.
Well said, Sir Sparhawk, the fat churchman on the right approved.
The Patriarch of Coombe leaned over and whispered something to the sallow man sitting beside him.
What did you do after you learned of this conspiracy, Sir Sparhawk? Dolmant asked then.
We gathered our forces and rode down into Arsham to intercept the men who were to carry out the attack.
And why did you not advise the Primate of Simera of this so-called conspiracy?
Markova asked.
The scheme involved an attack on a house in Arsham, Your Grace, Sparhawk replied. The Primate of Simera has no authority there, so the matter didn't concern him.
Nor the Pandions either, I should say. Why did you not just alert the Cyrenic Knights and let them deal with things?
Markova looked around smugly at those seated near him as if he had just made a killing point.
The plot was designed to discredit our order, Your Grace. We felt that gave us sufficient reason to attend to the matter ourselves. Besides, the Cyrenics have their own concerns, and we didn't want to trouble them with so minor an affair.
Markova grunted sourly.
What happened then, Sir Sparhawk? Dolmant asked.
Things went more or less as expected, Your Grace. We alerted Count Radon. Then, when the mercenaries arrived, we fell on them from behind. Not very many of them escaped.
You attacked them from behind without warning?
Patriarch Markova looked outraged.
Is this the vaunted heroism of the Pandion Knights?
You're nitpicking, Markova, the jovial-looking man on the other side of the aisle snorted. Your precious primate Annius made a fool of himself. Quit trying to smooth it over by attacking this knight or trying to impugn his testimony. He looked shrewdly at Sparhawk.
Would you care to hazard a guess as to the source of this conspiracy, Sir Sparhawk? He asked.
We are not here to listen to speculation, Emban, Markova snapped quickly. The witness can testify only to what he knows, not what he guesses.
The Patriarch of Coombe is right, Your Grace, Sparhawk said to Patriarch Emban. I swore to speak only the truth, and guesses usually fly wide of that mark. The Pandion Order has offended many people in the past century or so. We are sometimes an acerbic group of men, stiff-necked and unforgiving. Many find that quality in us unpleasant, and old hatreds die hard.
True, Emban conceded. If it came to the defense of the faith, however, I would prefer to place my trust in you stiff-necked and unforgiving Pandions rather than some others I could name. Old hatreds, as you say, die hard, but so do new ones. I've heard about what's going on in Elania, and it's not too hard to pick out somebody who might profit from the Pandion's disgrace.
Do you dare to accuse the Primate Annius?
Markova cried, jumping to his feet with his eyes bulging.
Oh, sit down, Markova. Emban said in disgust. You contaminate us by your very presence. Everybody in this chamber knows who owns you.
You accuse me?
Who paid for that new palace of yours, Markova? 6 months ago you tried to borrow money from me, but now you seem to have all you need. Isn't that curious?
Who's subsidizing you, Markova?
What's all the shouting about?
A feeble voice asked. Sparhawk looked sharply at the golden throne at the front of the chamber. The archprelate Clavonus had come awake, and was blinking in confusion as he looked around. The old man's head was wobbling on his stringy neck, and his eyes were bleary.
A spirited discussion, most holy, Dolman said mildly.
Now you went and woke me up,
the archprelate said petulantly.
And I was having such a nice dream.
He reached up, pulled off his mitre and threw it on the floor. Then he sank back on his throne, pouting.
Would the archprelate care to hear of the matter under discussion? Dolmant asked.
No, I wouldn't,
Savonis snapped.
So there.
Then he cackled as if his infantile outburst had been some enormous joke. The laughter trailed off and he scowled at them.
I want to go back to my room,
he declared.
Get out of here, all of you.
The hierocracy rose to its feet and began to file out.
You too, Dolmant,
the archprelate insisted in a shrill voice.
And send Sister Clintis to me. She's the only one who really cares about me.
As you wish, most holy, Dolmant said, bowing.
When they were outside, Sparhawk walked beside the Patriarch of Deimos. How long has he been like this? He asked. Dolmant sighed. For a year now, at least, he replied. His mind has been failing for quite some time, but it's only in the past year that his senility has reached this level. Who is Sister Clintis? His keeper. His nursemaid, actually. Is his condition widely known? There are rumors, of course, but we've managed to keep his true state a secret. Dolmant sighed again. Don't judge him by the way he is now, Sparhawk. When he was younger, he honored the throne of the Archprelacy. Sparhawk nodded. I know, he agreed. How is his health otherwise? Not good. He's very frail. It cannot be much longer. Perhaps that's why Aeneas is beginning to move so quickly. Sparhawk shifted his silver-embossed shield. Time's on his side, you know. Dolmant made a sour face. Yes, he agreed. That's what makes your mission so vital. Another churchman came up to join them.
Well, Dolmant, he said, a very interesting morning. Just how deeply was Aeneas involved in the scheme?
I didn't say anything about the Primate of Cimera, Yaris, Dolmant protested with mock innocence.
You didn't have to. It all fits together a bit too neatly.
I don't think anybody on the council missed your point.
Do you know the Patriarch of Ardanias, Sparhawk? Dolmant asked. We've met a few times.
Sparhawk bowed slightly to the other churchman, his armor creaking.
Your Grace, he said. It's good to see you again, Sir Sparhawk, Yaris replied. How are things in Cimera?
Tense, Sparhawk said. Patriarch Yaris looked at Dolmant. You know that Makava's going to report everything that happened this morning to Aeneas, don't you?
I wasn't trying to keep it a secret. Aeneas made an ass of himself. Considering his aspirations, that element of his personality is highly relevant.
It is indeed, Dolmant. You've made another enemy this morning.
Makava's never been that fond of me anyway. Incidentally, Yaris, Sparhawk and I would like to present a certain matter to you for your consideration.
Oh?
It involves another ploy by the Primate of Cimera.
Then let's thwart him by all means.
I was hoping you might feel that way about it.
What's he up to this time?
He presented a spurious marriage certificate to the Royal Council in Cimera.
Who got married?
Princess Arissa and Duke Oston.
That's ridiculous.
Princess Arissa said almost the same thing.
You'll swear to that?
Dolmant nodded. So will Sparhawk, he added.
I assume that the point of the whole thing was to legitimize Lycaeus?
Dolmant nodded again.
Well then, why don't we see if we can disrupt that? Let's go speak with my secretary. He can draw up the necessary document.
The Patriarch of Vardanias chuckled.
Aeneas is having a bad month, I'd say. This will make two plots in a row that have failed, and Sparhawk's been involved both times.
He looked at the big pendion.
Keep your armor on, my boy, he suggested. Aeneas might decide to have the area between your shoulder blades decorated with a dagger hilt.
After Dolmant and Sparhawk had given their depositions concerning the statements of Princess Arissa, they left the Patriarch of Vardanias and continued along the corridor to the nave of the Basilica.
Dolmant, Sparhawk said, do you have any idea about why so many Styrics are here in Kyrellos?
I've heard about it. The story is that they are seeking instruction in our faith.
Sophronia says that's an absurdity. Dolmant made a wry face.
She's probably right.
I've labored for a lifetime, and I haven't as yet managed to convert a single Styrek. They're very attached to their gods, Sparhawk said. I'm not trying to be offensive, Dolmant, but there seems to be a very close personal relationship between the Styreks and their gods. Our god is perhaps a bit remote. I'll mention that the next time I talk to him. Dolmant smiled. I'm sure he values your opinion. Sparhawk laughed. It was a bit presumptuous, wasn't it? Yes, as a matter of fact, it was. How long do you think it's going to be until you can leave for Barata? Several days, anyway. I hate to lose the time, but the knights from the other orders have long journeys to make to reach Kyrelos, and I'm more or less obliged to wait for them. All this waiting is making me very impatient, but there's no help for it, I'm afraid. He pursed his lips. I think I'll spend the time nosing around a bit. It'll give me something to do, and all these Styreks are making me curious. Be careful in the streets of Kyrelos, Sparhawk, Dolmant advised seriously. They can be very dangerous. The whole world is dangerous lately, Dolmant. I'll keep you posted on what I find out. Then Sparhawk turned and went down the corridor with his spurs clinking on the marble floor. Chapter 13. It was nearly noon when Sparhawk returned to the chapter house. He had ridden slowly through the busy streets of the holy city, paying scant attention to the crowds around him. The deterioration of the archprelate Clavonus had saddened him. Despite the rumors that had been circulating of late, actually to see the revered old man's condition had come as a profound personal shock. He stopped at the heavy gate and perfunctorily went through the ritual that admitted him. Colton was waiting in the courtyard. Well? The blonde man asked. How did it go? Sparhawk dismounted heavily and pulled off his helmet. I don't know if we've changed any minds, he replied. The patriarchs who support Aeneas still support him. The ones who oppose him are still on our side, and those who are neutral are still sitting on the fence. It was a waste of time, then? Not entirely, I guess. After this, it might be a little harder for Aeneas to win over any more uncommitted votes. I wish you'd make up your mind, Sparhawk. Colton looked closely at his friend. You're in a sour mood. What really happened? Clavonus was there. That's a surprise. How did he look? Awful. He is 85, Sparhawk. You couldn't expect him to look very impressive. People wear out, you know. His mind is gone, Colton, Sparhawk said sadly. He's childish now. Dolmant doesn't think he's going to last much longer. That bad? Sparhawk nodded. That makes it fairly important for us to get to Barata and back in a hurry then, doesn't it? Urgent, Sparhawk agreed. Do you think we should ride on ahead and let the knights from the other orders catch up with us later? I wish we could. I hate the idea of Alana sitting alone in a throne room, but I don't think we dare. Comier was right about a show of unity, and the other orders are sometimes a little touchy. Let's not start off by offending them. Did you and Dolmant talk to somebody about Orisa? Sparhawk nodded. The Patriarch of Vardanias is handling it. The day wasn't an absolute waste, then? Sparhawk grunted. I want a change out of this. He rapped on the breastplate of his armor with his knuckles. You want me to unsaddle Farron for you? No, I'll be going back out. Where's Sophrenia? In her room, I think. Have somebody saddle her horse. Is she going somewhere? Probably. Sparhawk went on up the stairs and entered the chapter house. It was about a quarter hour later when he tapped on Sophrenia's door. He had removed his armor and now wore a mail coat beneath a nondescript gray cloak that bore no insignia of his rank or his order. It's me, Sophrenia, he said through the panels of the door. Come in, Sparhawk, she said. He opened the door and stepped in quietly. She was sitting in a large chair with flute in her lap. The child was sleeping with a contented little smile on her face. Did things go well at the Basilica? Sophrenia asked. It's a little hard to say, he replied. Churchmen are very good at hiding their emotions. Did you and Colton find out anything yesterday about all the Styreks here in Kyrelos? She nodded. They're concentrated in the quarter near the East Gate. They have a house there somewhere that seems to be a headquarters of some sort.
We weren't able to locate it exactly, though. Why don't we go see if we can find it? He suggested. I need something to do. I'm feeling a bit restless.
Restless? You, Sparhawk? The man of stone?
Impatience, I suppose. I want to get started for Baratta. She nodded. Then she rose, lifting Flute easily, and laid the child on the bed. Gently, she covered the little girl with a gray wool blanket. Flute briefly opened her dark eyes, then smiled and went back to sleep. Sophronia kissed the small face, then turned to Sparhawk.
"Shall we go, then?"
she said. "You're very fond of her, aren't you?" Sparhawk asked, as the two of them walked along the corridor leading toward the courtyard.
"It goes a bit deeper than that. Someday, perhaps, you'll understand.
Have you any idea where this Styric house might be?"
"There's a shopkeeper in the market near the east gate. He sold some Styrics a number of sides of meat. The porter who delivered them knows where the house is."
"Why didn't you question the porter?"
"He wasn't there yesterday."
"Maybe he'll make it to work today."
"It's worth a try."
He stopped and gave her a direct look. "I'm not trying to pry into the secrets you've chosen not to reveal, Sophronia. But could you distinguish between ordinary rural Styrics and Zamoks?"
"It's possible," she admitted,
"unless they're taking steps to conceal their true identity." They went down into the courtyard where Calton waited with Farron and Sophronia's white palfrey.
The blonde knight had an angry expression on his face.
"Your horse bit me, Sparhawk," he said accusingly. "You know him well enough not to turn your back on him. Did he draw blood?"
"No," Calton admitted.
"Then he was only being playful. It shows that he likes you."
"Thanks," Calton said flatly.
"Do you want me to come along?"
"No. I think we want to be more or less inconspicuous, and on occasion you have trouble managing that."
"Sometimes your charm overwhelms me, Sparhawk. We're sworn to speak the truth." Sparhawk helped Sophronia into her saddle, then mounted Farron. "We should be back before dark," he told his friends. "Don't hurry on my account." Sparhawk led the small Styric woman out through the gate and into the side street beyond.
"He turns everything into a joke, doesn't he?" Sophronia observed.
"Most things, yes. He's been laughing at the world since he was a boy. I think that's why I like him so much. My view of things tends to be a little more bleak, and he helps me keep my perspective." They rode on through the now teeming streets of Kyrillos. Although many local merchants affected the somber black of churchmen, visitors usually did not, and their bright clothing stood out by contrast. Travelers from Camoria in particular were highly colorful, since their customary silk garments did not fade with the passage of time, and remained brightly red or green or blue. The marketplace to which Sophronia led him was some distance from the chapter house, and it was perhaps 3/4 of an hour before they reached it.
"How did you find this shopkeeper?" Sparhawk asked.
"There are certain staples in the Styric diet," she replied. "Alines don't eat those things very often."
"I thought you said that this porter delivered some sides of meat."
"Goat, Sparhawk. Alines don't care much for goat."
He shuddered.
"How provincial you are," she said lightly. "If it doesn't come from a cow, you won't eat it."
"I suppose it's what you're used to."
"I'd better go to the shop alone," she said. "Sometimes you're a bit intimidating, dear one. We want answers from the porter, and we might not get them if you frighten him. Watch my horse." She handed him her reins and then moved off through the market. Sparhawk watched as she went across the bustling square to speak with a shabby-looking fellow in a blood-smeared canvas smock. After a short time, she returned. He got down and helped her back onto her horse.
"Did he tell you where the house is?" he asked.
She nodded. "It's not far, near the east gate."
"Let's go have a look."
As they started out, Sparhawk did something uncharacteristically impulsive. He reached out and took the small woman's hand.
"I love you, little mother," he told her.
"Yes," she said calmly. "I know. It's nice of you to say it, though." Then she smiled. It was an impish little smile that somehow reminded him of Flute.
"Another lesson for you, Sparhawk," she said. "When you're having dealings with a woman, you cannot say, 'I love you,' too often."
"I'll remember that. Does the same thing apply to Aline women?"
"It applies to all women, Sparhawk. Gender is a far more important distinction than race."
I shall be guided by you, Sophronia.
Have you been reading medieval poetry again?
Me?
They rode through the marketplace and on into the run-down quarter near the east gate of Kyrillos. While not perhaps the same as the slums of Cimera, this part of the holy city was far less opulent than the area around the basilica. There was less color here, for one thing. The tunics of the men in the street were uniformly drab, and the few merchants there were in the crowd wore garments which were faded and threadbare. They did, however, have the self-important expressions which all merchants, successful or not, automatically assume. Then, at the far end of the street, Sparhawk saw a short man in a lumpy, unbleached smock of homespun wool. "Styrek," he said shortly. Sophronia nodded, and drew up the hood of her white robe so that it covered her face. Sparhawk straightened in his saddle and carefully assumed an arrogant, condescending expression, such as the servant of some important personage might wear. They passed the Styrek, who stepped cautiously aside without paying them any particular heed. Like all members of his race, the Styrek had dark, almost black hair and a pale skin. He was shorter than the Alenes who passed him in this narrow street, and the bones in his face were prominent, as if he had somehow not quite been completed. "They mock?" Sparhawk asked after they had passed the man. "It's impossible to say," Sophronia replied. "Is he concealing his identity with a spell?" She spread her hands helplessly. "There's no way to tell, Sparhawk. Either he's just an ordinary backwoods Styrek with nothing on his mind but his next meal, or he's a very subtle magician who's playing the bumpkin to block out attempts to probe him." Sparhawk swore under his breath. "This might not be as easy as I thought," he said. "Let's go on, then, and see what we can find out." The house to which Sophronia had been directed sat at the end of a cul-de-sac, a short street that went nowhere. "That's going to be difficult to watch without being obvious," Sparhawk said as they rode slowly past the mouth of the narrow street. "Not really," Sophronia disagreed. She reined in her palfrey. "We need to talk with the shopkeeper there on the corner."
"Did you want to buy something?"
"Not exactly buy, Sparhawk. Come along, you'll see." She slid down out of her saddle and tied the reins of her delicate white horse to a post outside the shop she had indicated. She looked around briefly. "Will your great war horse discourage anyone who might want to steal my gentle little Kiel?" she asked. She laid her hand affectionately on the white horse's neck.
"I'll talk to him about it."
"Would you?"
"Theron," Sparhawk said to the ugly roan, "stay here and protect Sophronia's mare." Theron nickered, his ears pricked eagerly forward. "You big old fool," Sparhawk laughed. Theron snapped at him, his teeth clacking together at the empty air inches from Sparhawk's ear. "Be nice," Sparhawk murmured. Inside the shop, a room devoted to the display of cheap furniture, Sophronia's attitude became ingratiating, even oddly submissive.
"Good master merchant," she said with an uncharacteristic tone in her voice, "we serve a great Pelosian noble who has come to Kyrillos to seek solace for his soul in the holy city."
"I don't deal with Styrex," the merchant said rudely, glowering at Sophronia. "There are too many of you filthy heathens in Kyrillos already."
He assumed an expression of extreme distaste, all the while making what Sparhawk knew to be totally ineffective gestures to ward off magic.
"Look, huckster," the big knight said, affecting an insulting Pelosian-accented manner, "do not rise above yourself. My masters Chatelain and I will be treated with respect, regardless of your feeble-minded bigotry." The shopkeeper bristled at that.
"Why?"
he began to bluster. Sparhawk smashed the top of a cheap table into splinters with a single blow of his fist. Then he seized the shopman's collar and pulled him forward so that they were eye to eye.
"Do we understand each other?" he said in a dreadful voice that hovered just this side of a whisper. "What we require, good master merchant," Sophronia said smoothly, "is a goodly set of chambers facing the street. Our master has been ever fond of watching the ebb and flow of humanity."
She lowered her eyelashes modestly.
"Have you such a place above stairs?"
The shopkeeper's face was a study in conflicting emotions as he turned to mount the stairs toward the upper floor. The chambers above were shabby, one might even go so far as to say ratty. They had at some time in the past been painted, but the pea-soup green paint had peeled and now hung in long strips from the walls.
Sparhawk and Sophronia were not interested in paint, however. It was to the dirty window at the front of the main chamber that their eyes went.
"There's more, little lady," the shopkeeper said, more respectfully than before.
"We can conduct our own inspection, good master merchant." She cocked her head slightly. "Was that the step of a customer I heard from below?" The shopkeeper blinked, and then he bolted downstairs. "Can you see the house up the street from the window?" Sophronia asked.
"The panes are dirty." Sparhawk lifted the hem of his gray cloak to wipe away the dust and grime.
"Don't," she said sharply. "Styric eyes are very sharp."
"All right," he said. "I'll look through the dust. Eileen eyes are just as sharp."
He looked at her.
"Does that happen every time you go out?" he asked.
"Yes. Common Eileens are not much smarter than common Styrics. Frankly, I'd rather have a conversation with a toad than with either breed."
"Toads can talk."
He was a little surprised at that.
"If you know what you're listening for, yes. They're not very stimulating conversationalists, though."
The house at the end of the street was not impressive. The lower floor was constructed of fieldstone, crudely mortared together, and the second story was of roughly squared-off timbers. It seemed somehow set off from the houses around it, as if drawing in a kind of isolated separateness. As they watched, a Styric wearing the poorly woven wool smock which was the characteristic garb of his race moved up the street toward the house. He looked around furtively before he entered.
"Well?" Sparhawk asked.
"It's hard to say," Sophronia replied. "It's the same as with that one we saw in the street. He's either simple or very skilled."
"This could take a while."
"Only until dark, if I'm right,"
she said as she drew a chair up to the window.
In the next several hours, a fair number of Styrics entered the house, and as the sun sank into a dense, dirty-looking cloud bank on the western horizon, others began to arrive. A Camorian in a bright yellow silk robe went furtively up the cul-de-sac and was immediately admitted. A booted Lamarck in a polished steel cuirass, and accompanied by two crossbow-bearing men-at-arms, marched arrogantly up to the doors of the house and gained entry just as quickly. Then, as the chill winter twilight began to settle over Kyrillos, a lady in a deep purple robe and attended by a huge manservant in bullhide armor, such as that commonly worn by Pelosians, went up the center of the short street, moving with a stiff-legged, abstracted pace. Her eyes seemed vacant, and her movements jerky. Her face, however, bore an expression of ineffable ecstasy.
"Strange visitors to a Styric house," Sophronia commented.
Sparhawk nodded and looked around the darkening room.
"Do you want some light?" he asked her.
"No, let's not be seen to be here. I'm certain that the street is being watched from the upper floor of the house." Then she leaned against him, filling his nostrils with the woody fragrance of her hair. "You can hold my hand, though," she offered. "For some reason I've always been a little afraid of the dark."
"Of course," he said, taking her small hand in his big one.
They sat together for perhaps another quarter hour as the street outside grew darker. Suddenly, Sophronia gave an agonized little gasp.
"What's the matter?" he asked in alarm.
She did not immediately reply, but rose to her feet instead, raising her hands, palms up above her. A dim figure seemed to stand before her, a figure that was more shadow than substance, and a faint glow seemed to stretch between its widespread gauntleted hands. Slowly it held forth that silvery nimbus. The glow grew momentarily brighter, then coalesced into solidity as the shadow before her vanished. She sank back into her chair, holding the long, slender object with a curious kind of sorrowful reverence.
"What was that, Sophronia?" Sparhawk demanded.
"Another of the 12 knights has fallen," she said in a voice that was almost a moan. "This is his sword, a part of my burden."
"Banion?"
he asked, almost choking with a dreadful sense of fear.
Her fingers sought the crest on the pommel of the sword she held, feeling the design in the darkness.
"No," she said. "It was Lacus."
Sparhawk felt a wrench of grief.
Lacus was an elderly Pandion, a man with snowy hair and a grim visage whom all the knights of Sparhawk's generation had revered as a teacher and a friend. Sophronia buried her face in Sparhawk's armored shoulder and began to weep. "I knew him as a boy, Sparhawk," she lamented. "Let's go back to the chapter house," he suggested gently. "We can do this another day." She lifted her head and wiped at her eyes with her hand. "No, Sparhawk," she said firmly. "Something's happening in that house tonight. Something that may not happen again for a while." He started to say something, but then he felt an oppressive weight that seemed to be located just behind his ears. It was as if someone had just placed the heels of his hands at the back of his skull and pushed inward. Sophronia leaned intently forward. "Azash," she hissed. "What? They're summoning the spirit of Azash," she said with a terrible note of urgency in her voice. "That nails it down, then, doesn't it?" he said, rising to his feet. "Sit down, Sparhawk. This isn't played out yet." "There can't be that many. And what will you learn if you go up the street and chop the house and everyone in it to pieces? Sit down. Watch and learn." "I'm obliged, Sophronia. It's part of the oath. It has been for 5 centuries. "Bother the oath," she snapped. "This is more important." He sank back into his chair, troubled and uncertain. "What are they doing?" he asked. "I told you. They're raising the spirit of Azash. That can only mean that they're Zamox." "What are the Alines doing in there, then? The Camorian, the Lamarck, and that Pelosian woman?" "Receiving instruction, I think. The Zamox didn't come here to learn, but to teach. This is serious, Sparhawk. More deadly serious than you could ever imagine."
"What do we do?"
"For the moment, nothing. We sit here and watch." Again, Sparhawk felt that oppressive weight at the base of his skull, and then a fiery tingling that seemed to run through all his veins. "Azash has answered the summons," Sophronia said quietly. "It's very important to sit quietly now and for both of us to keep our thoughts neutral. Azash can sense hostility directed at him." "Why would Alines participate in the rites of Azash?" "Probably for the rewards he will give them for worshipping him. The Elder Gods have always been most lavish with their rewards, when it suits them to be."
"What kind of reward could possibly pay for the loss of one's soul?"
She shrugged, a barely perceptible motion in the growing darkness. "Longevity, perhaps? Wealth? Power? And in the case of the woman, beauty? It could even be other things, things I don't care to think about. Azash is twisted, and he soon twists those who worship him." In the street below, a workman with a handcart and a torch clattered along over the cobblestones. He took an unlighted torch from the cart, set it in an iron ring protruding from the shop front below, and ignited it. Then he rattled on. "Good," Sophronia murmured. "Now we'll be able to see them when they come out."
"We've already seen them."
"They'll be different, I'm afraid." The door to the Styric house opened, and the silk-robed Camorian emerged. As he passed through the circle of torchlight below, Sparhawk saw that his face was very pale, and his eyes were wide with horror. "That one will not return," Sophronia said quietly. "Most likely he'll spend the rest of his life trying to atone for his venture into the darkness." A few minutes later, the booted Lamarck came out into the street. His eyes burned, and his face was twisted into an expression of savage cruelty. His impassive crossbowman marched along behind him.
"Lost,"
Sophronia sighed.
"What?"
"The Lamarck is lost. Azash has him."
Then the Pelosian lady emerged from the house. Her purple robe was carelessly open at the front, and beneath it she was naked. As she came into the torchlight, Sparhawk could see that her eyes were glazed, and that her nude body was spattered with blood. Her hulking attendant made some effort to close the front of her robe, but she hissed at him, thrusting his hand away, and went off down the street, shamelessly flaunting her body.
"And that one is more than lost," Sophronia said. "She will be dangerous now. Azash rewarded her with powers."
She frowned.
"I'm tempted to suggest that we follow her and kill her."
"I'm not sure that I could kill a woman, Sophronia."
She She's not even a woman anymore. But we'd have to behead her, and that could cause some outrage in Kyrillos.
Do what?
Behead her. It's the only way to be certain that she's really dead. I think we've seen enough here, Sparhawk. Let's go back to the chapter house and talk with Nashan. Tomorrow I think we should report this to Dolmant. The church has ways to deal with this sort of thing. She rose to her feet. Let me carry the sword for you.
No, Sparhawk. It's my burden. I must carry it.
She tucked Lachesis's sword inside her robe and led the way toward the door.
They went downstairs again, and the shopkeeper came out of the back of his establishment rubbing his hands together.
Well, he said eagerly, will you be taking the rooms?
Totally unsuitable, Sophronia sniffed. I wouldn't keep my master's dog in a place like that.
Her face was very pale, and she was visibly trembling.
But...
Just unlock the door, neighbor, Sparhawk said, and we'll be on our way.
What took you so long, then?
Sparhawk gave him a flat, cold stare, and the shopkeeper swallowed hard and went to the door, fishing in his tunic pocket for the key. Outside, Farron was standing protectively beside Sophronia's palfrey. There was a torn scrap of rough cloth on the cobblestones under his hooves.
Trouble?
Sparhawk asked him.
Farron snorted derisively.
I see, Sparhawk said.
What was that about? Sophronia asked wearily as Sparhawk helped her to mount.
Someone tried to steal your horse, he shrugged. Farron persuaded him not to.
Can you really communicate with him?
I more or less know what he's thinking. We've been together for a long time. He hauled himself up into his saddle, and the two of them rode off down the street in the direction of the Pandion chapter house. They had gone perhaps a half mile when Sparhawk had a momentary premonition. He reacted instantly, driving Farron's shoulder against the white palfrey. The smaller horse lurched to one side, even as a crossbow bolt buzzed spitefully through the space where Sophronia had been an instant before.
"Ride, Sophronia!" he barked as the bolt clashed against the stones of a house fronting the street.
He looked back, drawing his sword, but Sophronia had already thumped her heels to the white horse's flanks and plunged off down the street at a clattering gallop, with Sparhawk closely behind her, shielding her body with his own. After they had crossed several streets, Sophronia slowed her pace.
"Did you see him?"
she asked. She had Lachesis's sword in her hand now.
"I didn't have to see him. A crossbow means a lamark. Nobody else uses them."
"The one who was in the house with the styrix?"
"Probably. Unless you've gone out of your way to offend other lamarks of late.
Could Azash or one of his Zaymoks have sensed your presence back there?"
"It's possible," she conceded. "No one can be absolutely certain just how far the power of the Elder Gods goes. How did you know that we were about to be attacked?"
"Training, I suppose. I've learned to know when someone's pointing a weapon at me."
"I thought it was pointed at me."
"It amounts to the same thing, Sophronia."
"Well, he missed.
This time. I think I'll talk to Nashan about getting you a male shirt."
"Are you mad, Sparhawk?" she protested. "The weight alone would put me on my knees, not to mention the awful smell."
"Better the weight and the smell than an arrow between the shoulder blades."
"Totally out of the question."
"We'll see. Put the sword away and let's move on. You need rest, and I want to get you inside the chapter house where it's safe before someone else takes a shot at you."
Chapter 14
The following day, about mid-morning, Sir Bavier arrived at the gates of the Pandion chapter house in Kyrillos. Sir Bavier was a Cyrenic knight from Arsham. His formal armor was burnished to a silvery sheen, and his surcoat was white. His helmet had no visor, but rather bore heavy cheek pieces and a formidable nose guard. He dismounted in the courtyard, hung his shield and his Lochaber axe on his saddle bow, and removed his helmet. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.